Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the third weekend of September 2025. We are right upon the fall equinox here and heading into the dark half of the year. It has been much more fall-like weather here the past couple of weeks in Sitka with wind and rain, fall storms kind of blowing in off the Gulf. Good time to watch for birds. I haven't seen too much myself, having quite a bit of stuff to do, so unfortunately didn't get a chance to get out and look. But if you are, please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded early this month with Bree Drummond. She is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and part of her responsibility is St. Lazaria Island here in Sitka Sound. So we'll go ahead and join the conversation with her introducing herself and going from there.
My name is Bree Drummond. I'm a wildlife biologist, and I work for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, which is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
For folks in Sitka, that's Lazaria.
Yes.
St. Lazaria. But generally speaking, you know, that spans the entire state, essentially coast.
Yeah, correct. So it's about 2,400 islands and headlands all the way from southeast Alaska out west to Attu at the end of the Aleutian Chain, and then up north to Cape Thompson, Cape Lisburn, the Chukchi Sea.
So you're the primary wildlife biologist for the refuges,
whole refuge? Well, we have multiple wildlife biologists, and we're divided geographically, and so okay. I'm the primary biologist that oversees our work in the Gulf of Alaska and along the Alaska Peninsula.
All right.
And then we have other biologists that work in the Aleutian Islands and the Bering Sea and Chukchi Sea.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of area to cover for one person, I imagine, especially if you, I mean, because the field season is presumably summer. I imagine a lot of these places aren't visited much, if at all, and the birds probably aren't even. I mean, I suppose it means wildlife, but in practice, it's mostly birds that you're talking about.
Right. So all the wildlife refuges in Alaska, of which there are 13, were established for different reasons. And Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, one of the primary focuses is on seabirds. And so for that, we are pretty much monitoring them at colonies during the breeding season, which is generally May through September-ish.
Yeah. It'd be formidable to try and visit outside of those seasons. I mean, it's tough enough, I suppose, at times, even during the nice weather season.
Well, even if we could, most of them aren't there.
Yeah.
So seabirds are at the colony during the summer, and then during the winter, they mostly disperse out into the water, and some of them travel hundreds or thousands of miles away.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Yeah, it is. I had a chance to go out to Lazaria with my son. We had relatively nice weather in March. Last couple of days of March this year. And I know Lazaria is quiet when there's, you know, it's not the season, but, and it was just interesting. It was very quiet out there. There was not much going on, nothing really to see. I mean, it's a remarkable island regardless, just because the geology and the form of it is pretty spectacular. But yeah, not a lot of bird activity there compared to, you know, later. And I'm not sure when they start showing up. I mean, I imagine you all want to be there around the time that they're starting, but how do you decide when to set up your shop there for monitoring?
Well, the different species have slightly different timelines. Some of the storm petrels start coming back as early as April. Most of the breeding efforts in terms of birds starting to build nests and lay eggs starts to happen in May and June. So
yeah.
We have our crews generally show up late May-ish. And that's kind of a balance between when the birds start, but also how much money we have,
right,
and the length of the season,
yeah,
that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like, I mean, if there's not a whole lot going on, it's... Storm petrels are an interesting one because they're the most numerous, if I'm understanding correctly, they're the most numerous breeding seabird species on Lazaria. I mean, there's two species of them.
Yes, fork-tailed and leeches storm petrels, and combined, we think there's about 500,000.
Right. What's fascinating about it, because it's like orders of magnitude more than all the alcids combined, and
yeah,
we see the alcids all the time, puffins and murres and rhinoceros auklets and all of those. But the storm petrels, we just don't see. I saw one leeches storm petrel in the evening. And every once in a while you hear stories, like somebody that worked on the ferry and they would be docked at Sitka during the night, and the leeches storm petrels, he had a picture of one, and he's like, oh yeah, these come in August, you know, they're just flying around the lights. And in the fall, the Raptor Center gets storm petrels, both species, they get stranded, you know, and you'll find some years you'll find ones where they've gotten predated on, you'll just find their wings or whatever. But it's an interesting thing. The fork-tails, you'll see often in the fall, they'll get, especially we have stormy weather, and they'll stay around all day and you'll see them on the water near shore. Leeches storm petrels, not. We had a really big storm, I don't know, 3-4 years ago. And there were leeches, storm petrels first thing in the morning when I was out. And I saw them just right like in the channel here and right along the shore. And then they disappeared. And I'm like, and people are occasionally reporting, but certainly not 500,000 more. So presumably they're going well offshore for their for
right.
Their
they forage pretty far offshore and they can fly really long distances and be gone for days at a time.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, hundreds of miles even.
I see. So they're not coming back and forth every day. They're
not every day, every few days.
Yeah.
Storm petrel chicks are actually pretty neat. They're kind of really well adapted to this binge feeding where they don't have to be fed all the time. And they can lower their metabolism and go in a kind of torpor for a few days in between feedings. And then when the adults come back, they get fed and their metabolism kind of cranks up and
ramps up.
Yeah.
Well, one other thing I noticed that I'm guessing was storm petrels just because of the magnitude is if you look at the Bjork Island radar at night during migration, like now, if you look at it in these clear days, you'll just see, you know, once the sun sets, there's this massive river of birds basically moving south this time of year. But I noticed at times in the summer, there's this interesting, like coming in from one direction, going out the other direction at night at Lazaria, and then it's not there during the day. And so on clear days when there's no other sort of interference, you just see that. And I was guessing that it's like storm petrels coming in and leaving.
Probably, yeah. Yep. Yeah. So they're nocturnal at the colony, and so they come in at night and feed their chicks and then leave again before it gets light. So
yeah,
that's neat.
I guess they're dispersed enough that they're not really showing up on radar until they're really getting close
enough.
And
then they get like kind of funneled in or concentrated. Yeah.
It might be an artifact of the radar or something, but it seemed like they were coming in from one direction and leaving in another direction, like they weren't crossing paths.
Neat.
Yeah. So the storm petrels, 500,000 of them foraging out, and they're, I mean, here, I don't imagine you've done, like, the geolocators or anything, but is there much information, do you know, of that done somewhere? Just, like, getting a better understanding of their foraging patterns?
So we've actually, this is the second year of us deploying geolocators on storm petrels out in St. Louis area. But that is mostly to determine where they're going in the winter. And so to kind of look at summertime foraging, you'd have to put GPS tags on, which kind of have a much better spatial resolution.
Right.
And we haven't done that.
I see.
All we know in terms of where they're foraging is observations at sea, kind of.
Yeah.
Which is pretty limited.
So the geolocator, that's the day length and timing. So you can basically estimate essentially.
Yeah, it measures light level. And so you can get sunsets and sunrises and from that determine a lat long.
Yeah. Less effective in the summer where it's north and lots of light.
Yep. And when they're spending a lot of time in burrows, because then it's kind of artificially dark during the daytime.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Do they have, you know, is one of the adults staying with the egg or the chick part of the time, or are they both going out? Or
there is an adult with the egg for a lot of the time, but they can, the eggs are pretty hardy and they can withstand some neglect. And so sometimes if one of the adults doesn't come back in time and the other bird can just leave, they can still survive. And then when the chick hatches, the adults for storm petrels usually stays just about 5 days. Mm. And then after that, they leave the chick in the burrow by themselves. At that point, they're able to thermoregulate on their own. Mm. And then they only come back to the burrow to feed the chicks at night.
Just to feed at night, and they're coming and going. Yeah, I remain fascinated by there's so many of them, but it would be interesting to just have the GPS locators on those for the summer, like how far are they wandering? And these random ones that, you know, that's the other thing with leeches, storm petrels, they aren't seen nearly as often, by birders around town as storm pet forktails. But in the summer, every once in a while, you'll just have somebody report one, see one just like flying through the channel in the middle of the day or just like kind of randomly, whereas forktails you don't really have that. You know, there's a concentrated time when you tend to see them. And some of them are around throughout the winter. There's some folks that fish winter kings here that see them like heading out by. But scary often. You know, they're still in the dark when they're heading out to go fishing. But
cool.
Six is a very small number compared to 500,000. So,
well, one of my tasks this fall and winter will be to analyze all the tags that we collected this year from the first winter's worth of geolocator tracking and figure out exactly where they went this winter. So,
yeah, well, that'll be interesting to find out. Yeah, are they? 500,000 is a lot of birds to look through. Are they pretty faithful to a particular nest? The same pair will return to the same nest, or are they mixing it up from year to year?
Yeah, they have really strong fidelity to an individual nest site. And so that's how we're able to do a tagging project like that, is we target a bird in a nest and then put the tag on. And then next year we go back to that same nest and hope they come back. And the recovery rates are pretty high.
Oh.
So a lot of them do return to that exact same burrow.
Because
otherwise, I mean, it'd be like a needle in a haystack, right?
Yeah.
We'd never find them again.
So. Unless you had little RFID tags or something.
Yeah,
or
wander around the entire
hunt. Wand and listen for the beeps or something. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty wild. You know, it's funny because I guess because in our minds, it's so easy to just be, well, they're just all interchangeable. They're not individuals like we are, but we have our own houses. You know, we wouldn't dream of going just randomly to somebody else. I mean, we move every once in a while, but, you know, once our house is our house. So there's a familiarity there, and it worked before, mm-hmm. probably is going to work again. And so, yeah, it is just interesting, the assumptions, I guess, that I have baked in about, like, how often that might happen. But time after time, you know, when we've looked at bird studies just locally, did some banding studies on songbirds, and they're coming back to the same yards winter after winter, or, you know, we're just there. And it's like, well, they know the predators, they know the, you know, the food sources, and they're familiar with the places to hide. Why would you? Why wouldn't you do that? Why would you go someplace else where you have to learn all of that again?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's interesting that they're, even when they're just there for the summer. And I heard this year your crew had to leave a little early earlier than you would typically because of a bear got on there.
Right. So it's not unheard of. I think about 20 years ago, the crew also had sign of a bear, but it's been a long time. And so this year, the crew started seeing scat all over the island and trails through the salmon bear that the bear had crushed, and then eventually saw the bear itself. And at that point, we just weren't really set up to have the camp protected for bears. I mean, the cabin's full of food and they have all this trash and stuff. They left for a little bit and we went back just this past week to kind of collect some final data and to close up the camp, and no sign of the bear. So
yeah,
it had clearly left sometime in the interim. But
well, it's interesting. And I mean, I remember hearing about that bear, you know, however long, 20 years ago, however long ago it was. And it even then being commented that it's not, you know, maybe one will kind of move through and pass by, but it seems like maybe they don't like, do they not like to eat little chicks or something? Because it seems like a bear could just really make quick work of, you know, they're good at digging.
The bear that was here this summer was at least out there for 2 weeks by the time our crew left, and they observed it digging up roots and vegetation, but we didn't see any sign that it was digging up the burrows, which, I mean, the soil out there is super soft.
Yeah.
A bear could easily just dig them up. So
yeah.
I don't know if they just weren't interested or didn't occur to them or what, but there were lots of fat chicks sitting in burrows just waiting, unprotected.
I mean, bears are smart enough. I figure it's like once one figured it out. But, I mean, that colony's been there a long time, so presumably.
But then I'm also not surprised at this time of year. I mean, there's no freshwater streams and no salmon on the island. And so it seems like, they would definitely want to move on.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, that summer sort of lull before the salmon really start coming back, and you know, I guess they've been eating vegetation during the summer, especially if it was a bad bear year. But I don't know. Are there other, like, I imagine weasels, mink, marten, otter. Well, marten, probably not. I don't think of them as swimming much, but mink and otter for sure.
River otters and minks we see on the island on occasion. It's not an annual thing.
Oh, not even annual.
Huh. Yep. Some years there seems to be just a few that kind of hang out for a lot of the summer, but then some years our crews don't see any sign of them. So,
and they're not, are they bothering the birds?
Those do prey on
the
seabirds for sure.
Yeah.
They usually actually, at the campsite, we have a kind of tent platform set up for overflow people and supplies and stuff. And oftentimes they'll use that tent platform to kind of cache the carcasses.
Oh, geez.
And the season when you're packing up and you lift up the tent platform, you'll see just kind of a whole cache of seabird carcasses they've stashed over the course of the summer.
I mean, yeah, I guess it's hard for a family of otters to put much of a dent in 500,000 storm petrels. I mean, they could, I guess, if they targeted some of the lower abundance alcids, maybe they could.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, they're native predators out there. And so that's just kind of part of the natural ecosystem. So,
yeah. Well, it's interesting because I have seen them more than once on Low Island, which I guess it's a little closer to land than Lazaria, but it definitely has more shoreline beach, the tidal area. This area is so steep coming in and out of the water. There's not a lot of tidal area there. So maybe that is more attractive to those because they like to forage in the intertidal stuff too, and the fishing and that. It's such a wild place out there. So the typically, I mean, you mentioned 20 years ago there was a crew, and I remember listening to a talk by Leslie Slater, who maybe it was your position before. Mm-hmm.
Leslie was a biologist who ran that camp before I did, before she retired.
And this was quite some years ago at this point, but I remember her talking about it being 17 years that they'd been running at the time that this talk was given. I think there was some early sort of monitoring in the 80s that I remember hearing about, but has it been pretty continuous since the 90s?
Yep, pretty much since 93, 94. We consider it one of our annual camps, so we send a crew out there every year. There have been a few exceptions, so 2020 with COVID and stuff, we didn't have a camp. And then the summer right after Leslie retired, we didn't have a camp because of budgetary issues and the fact that we didn't have a biologist in that position. So that was 2017. So, but other than 2017 and 2020, we've had a camp there every summer since the mid-90s.
And if people are interested in sort of, I mean, is this going into the information you're compiling, going into like annual reports or something that are accessible to people?
Yeah, so we write annual reports from the data every year, and they're freely available. We post them online through ARLIS, which is kind of this, and ServCat, which are kind of government sites, but we can all, it's easy to email to people around and that sort of stuff. We also sometimes papers get written from some of the data and published in scientific journals and stuff, but mostly it's in reports.
I remember seeing some, maybe it was a paper that Leslie had written that was just kind of looking at some trends over time or something. And I mean, one of the things that fascinates me is just like long-term variability and what's normal from a variability from year to year. Like maybe you have a really good few years and a really bad few years or whatever, and in a given area just as I've gotten older and kind of paid more attention more carefully over the last 20-25 years or so, just recognizing some years are weird and sort of inexplicably so. This year, to say nothing, we're sitting here at the second day of September as we're recording this, maybe reaching the end of this sunny streak that we've been having, where it's been we're going to easily break the record for days in a row with temperature of at least 65 here in Sitka. I think the prior record is 13, and if the forecast holds, it's going to continue that into the weekend. We'll be up into pushing 20 maybe by the time all said and done. Probably not quite that high, but it's most summers, 4 days is about as much days in a row you'll get 65. But this is in contrast with, I don't know if you came to help set up the camp in April, May, and the gray, cool, like into the first half of June, it was just like, it was not warming up at all. It was cold and wet and not very sunny. And there's some monitors that show the amount of daylight. And if you look at the total daylight for some of those days in May and June, it was more typical of what you'd expect in March. Mm-hmm. And so it was just like, it was a little grim.
Yeah. Oh, no. I was out there for about a week at the end of May, and I think it rained every day.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Which is, what we're used to kind of thing. So this has been quite a stretch.
Yeah. Being able to take down camp in sunny and warm. It's a little breezy, probably out there especially, but
it's just luxurious.
Yeah.
You can get your work and close up camp so much faster when it's nice and dry and sunny. And
you don't have to air everything out twice,
No, we're all putting on sunscreen every day.
Yeah, yeah. So are the birds are still, are they mostly starting to leave there now? I mean, we're into September.
So most of the birds, their breeding seasons are wrapping up. Gulls have fledglings, oyster catchers have fledglings, puffins around our socklets are fledging, murres are fledging. The storm petrels are a little bit later.
So
the two species are a little bit different in their timing. Fork-tailed storm petrels are starting to fledge now, but leeches storm petrels won't fledge until September or October.
Wow.
So they stay late.
They're getting started the earliest also, so they just have a long...
Well, they start about 3 or 4 weeks after the fork-tailed.
Oh, no, petrels. I bet at the storm petrels
in general. Storm petrels have an incredibly long breeding season compared to a lot of seabirds.
And they're just... I guess if they're abandoning them... I mean, if you're only getting food every few days then and you're slowing things down, I guess that would slow things down.
But. Yeah, so storm petrel chicks typically fledge when they're about 50 or 60 days old, and like for comparison, puffins, it's more around 35 or so. Right. And yeah. gulls are, you know, in the 30 range. So
yeah.
It's quite a bit longer than a lot of the other seabirds.
So are you monitoring? So you mentioned oyster catchers. Are you monitoring oyster catchers
yeah.
there?
Yep. There's usually about 6 or 7 nests on the island every year that our crews monitor.
And did they, how was their nesting success there this year?
Well, they had some nests that produce fledglings.
Yeah.
They nest a lot amongst the gulls, and the gulls are their predators. So yeah. it's amazing that any
yeah.
survive in my mind. But yeah, no, they did okay.
I remember, what was his name? Dave, I can't remember his last name now, but he came and gave a talk on oyster catchers, Prince William Sound. He was talking about how oyster catchers is like, it makes you wonder how they survive because they are literally nesting and their eggs will get washed away in a high tide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're just, it seems a little nuts, but they seem to do all right.
They do. I mean, they relay eggs a lot. And so it's pretty common for them to lose their first clutch of eggs due to predation or, yeah, high tides or storms. And they'll lay another batch and sometimes they survive. So.
Huh. Yeah, I was a place that I like to go birding in the Sound has oyster catchers. And this year, it just like walking around, you see the nests. And so I went there a handful of times over this summer. And there was I saw the net and the oyster catchers never were on the nests or even around the nests necessarily. I did find a few eggs that were like they'd been punched in, it looked like. Mm. So something found them and presumably ate them. And then there just never seemed to be any chicks. It got later and later. It's like, well, maybe they just weren't successful because it was so cool early. And if they weren't sitting on the eggs, maybe that mattered. I don't know. And then eventually I didn't see any eggs anymore, probably after some high tides. But I never saw any fledglings either. And maybe the fledglings are just super good at hiding, but I never saw any young birds.
Usually when this time of season, you'll see them because they're almost adult size.
Yeah.
Their bills are a little bit different.
I did see one the other day that had the darker bill. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that one looks like a juvenile, but a hatchier bird. And it was about adult size, but it was not, I didn't know if it had hatched on the island where I was at or if it had flown in from somewhere else. It was big enough to be flying. So.
Yeah.
I was just kind of curious. I don't know what other, I don't know what impact. They live around, this area. So obviously they are reasonably well adapted to the sorts of weather that we get here. And that can be cool and rainy for sure. So, yeah, I was kind of curious about that. So, and then are you also, I know occasionally peregrine falcons nest out there and eagles nest out there. Are you monitoring those as well?
We don't do much monitoring with those. That's really mostly just kind of anecdotal observations where one of the tasks our crew does all summer is maintain a daily observation list of birds and species that they see nesting and that sort of thing. So they'll record if the falcons or the eagles are nesting, but we don't really do much monitoring. They'll note, how many chicks they see.
Yeah.
It's been a few years since peregrines have actually successfully nested on the island.
Yeah, I remember, maybe the last time they did, they were on a cliff. A lot of times they're on that really tall cliff that's kind of facing Mount Edgecombe, but they were on a shorter cliff on a ledge kind of in the middle of it. And there was, I don't know if it was ultimately successful, but the young bird was pretty big by the time I saw it. It was kind of late summer. But that may have been the last time they were out there. It is... Yeah, those birds sometimes the eagles and imagine the reason the peregrines are nesting there is because there's food, right?
Mm-hmm.
The eagles are rough on the murres and other things getting out there. And the gulls, I suppose that's probably part of why they're also nesting there. They not just the oyster catchers, I imagine they're getting eggs and stuff from the other birds as well.
They eat a lot of fish and intertidal stuff out there too, but also the birds. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. I see the eBird reports. It's not every year, but it seems like the last couple of years, the crew out there has been doing eBird reports. So mm-hmm. I'll see those eBird reports come in, and I'll be like, oh, I'd like to see that bird. this year, it was a black pole warbler that was out there. Somebody mm-hmm. saw or heard. Maybe they heard it singing. And I can't remember if they saw it or not. But eastern kingbird, I don't remember if there's one of those. There's a couple of rare birds this year. Last year, I think there was a stilt sandpiper out there. I've never seen one of those. So I'm just like, oh, be nice to see those, but Sitka proper is sort of tucked back in here. And I think there's a lot of stuff that's just moving up and down.
Yep.
You know, the outer part and flying across the opening of the sound there.
But, well, and a lot of times when we get those more unusual birds, they don't stick around. You know,
right?
They see them or hear them for a day or two, and then they're gone.
Yeah,
so.
that is the joy and the struggle of birds, I guess. You never know.
Yep.
And when you do find them, it's often only a short time. Yeah, this year, I guess there was a redhead out there. It was out on the water. They had actually scope photos of the redhead out with the MERS kind of off the south end of the island, which was redheads we don't get here very often. But my son and I had actually been out there, I think, the day before or something like that, and we didn't, you know, it's only so many times you want to look through all the MERS. So,
that's,
you know,
true.
You find your thick-billed MER and move on. And that is, I guess that's another question. I remember hearing some years ago that like up to a third of the MERS there were thick-billed MERS, but that doesn't seem like what I'm noticing when I'm seeing them on the water.
No, I don't think that's that many anymore. So there definitely seems, I don't know, maybe it's 1 in 10 now.
Is it that many even?
A little bit less, but yeah. So it seems to be predominantly common MERS. We definitely have both out there, and our crews kind of measure both, but it's, I think it's different ratios than it was in the past.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those things where I had wondered, like, it's a different thing when you're able to look at them on the nesting cliffs and that kind of thing and sort of study them and see them that way. And when you see them on the water, I'm just like, it feels like it's more like 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 that I'm seeing on the water. But it could be that their behavior is different and the thick builds just aren't hanging around the island. Like when they leave the nest, they're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be, especially if there's any kind of, which there almost always is, lump out there. It's a little bit of a challenge to pick out the thick build MERS.
Yeah.
I mean, when I see them, they're clear enough, but it's just so many MERS and going up and down binoculars, not the best mix. And are they still, I remember Leslie talking about, or maybe it was somebody else that have worked out there, talking about being in a little like inflatable going around the outside and like with binoculars and trying to
so for instance, there's a cave out there where MERS nest inside.
Oh, right.
And so
yeah,
the only way to get counts of those is in a boat. We usually don't have one. Previously, it used to be a crew of maybe three to seven people during the season, and now we just have a crew of two.
Okay.
And so with just two, we usually don't keep a skiff out there for them to use by themselves. But occasionally, we have an opportunity to do those water-based counts. And yeah, then it's usually, you know, some people have a really strong stomach for it, and some people counting through binoculars as you're bobbing up and down is just has them puking over the side. So,
well, and they're coming and going all the time, the birds.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're just like, I don't know how you, I mean, I guess there must be standardized techniques for that allow you to make comparisons, even if they're not exact, you know, counts, just because things are coming and going so constantly at those merc.
Well, so
especially,
our technique is to do multiple counts. And so we'll count multiple times and hope for a couple of counts there within 5%.
Yeah.
And then you just keep counting until you get that.
I mean, with digital cameras these days, is that something that folks use just because you can just snap pictures and then you can
absolutely
count
we do that a lot.
Yeah.
And it's one of the hard things with MERS, though, is that it can be hard to tell the species apart from a photograph.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're there in person, you usually can. So, but for other species that aren't intermixed or that sort of thing, we're starting to do more and more photo counts for sure.
So I don't know if you know the numbers off the top of your head. My impression is that number of MERS there is kind of order of 6,000-ish. Is that, and I'm never quite sure if that's pairs or
I think numbers. That's probably lower than that now.
Okay.
My impression is that there's few, particularly when I look at old plot photos, for instance, my impression is that, and we have trend information for a number of those plots, and numbers have definitely gone down since the 90s.
Okay.
So I would guess, I don't know, 3,000 to 4,000 kind of these days.
Pretty good number of birds still. I mean, it's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
You look up the cliffs and you're like, oh, it doesn't look like many birds up there. And then like an eagle fly over and suddenly it's just this waterfall of MERS just like cascading off the cliffs. It's kind of remarkable to see that. I remember one person telling me that was out there and they saw an eagle kind of land at the top of the cliff and all these MERS kind of come and eggs were like falling off with them when they, I'm like, how do they have any success at all? Are they re-laying eggs? Or I mean, they're knocking their own eggs off when they're scared by an eagle, and there's eagles out there all the time.
They can relay, but also sometimes what happens is they're really likely to flush early in the season when not very many birds have eggs, but then there's kind of safety in numbers, and so as more and more birds lay, they are more inclined to stay and not flush. And once they kind of reach whatever threshold they think, they kind of stick around more and have a little bit more protection.
I see. So that makes sense. Yeah, and I think it was an early season that, you know, observation that the person
So early season we see that, or if it's a failure year, and so a lot of birds have failed, and there's not many birds that still have eggs or chicks, then they're really prone to flushing and that sort of thing.
Do you, You said you looked at trends a little bit. I remember, what was it, 2014 or something, where there's just mer die-offs all over the Alaska, probably all over the wildlife refuge system, and mers were showing up way inland, just weird places because they were starving, so many of them. And we had, you know, not like crazy amounts of wash-ups here, strandings here, but there was plenty. And the eagles were getting them all the time. You know, you just find the breastbone and the wings and the feathers. It's because the eagles would eat everything else. They'd just be in the woods. Would it be an event like that, or is it more of a steady trend kind of thing?
Well, it can be both. So the trend that has been happening on St. Lazare has kind of been more of a steady trend. What's really interesting is that mer die-off event that you're talking about, which was the result of a big warm water blob or marine heat wave, that caused common mer colonies in the Gulf of Alaska and up in the Bering Sea. We lost half to three quarters of the birds from those colonies. That actually didn't happen in St. Lazare. So there's a little bit of a dip, but in general, we didn't see like half the birds on the plot gone. So for whatever reason, maybe this colony is more connected with the California current sort of ecosystem and less of what was happening in the Western Gulf. But yeah. There were, as you said, like a few birds, but we didn't see kind of the mass die-offs of the colony that we saw in other places. So here it's kind of been just a more gradual decline since the 90s.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, my recollection is that it was kind of on the order of tens and dozens, tens to on a given area, as opposed to there, people like hundreds and thousands were washing up and that kind of a thing. And we have mers wintering here, including the occasional thick-billed mer. And I'm not sure, I don't know if they've looked at, you know, you said you're studying the storm petrels wintering behavior, how they migrate and travel. I don't know if that's been done with mers or not, because like I don't have any idea whether the mers here in the winter are the same ones nesting on Lazaria or if they're shuffling around, you know, the region more and, you know, like some of the songbirds do.
So, I think that they're the same. So what we think we know about mer over winter is that they're not long-distance migrants, but they just they go out into the Gulf or from this area and maybe a little bit south and just probably hang out and probably is some intermingling with some of the other mer colonies around. But they're not, you know, traveling thousands of miles kind of thing. And so I'm sure the ones that you see here are ones that just stuck a little bit closer to home.
Yeah, I'm trying to think it depends on the year. I am sure that they're following food. I can't imagine there. But pretty much every year there's mers in Silver Bay. And many years there's thick-billed mer in with them, maybe a couple. It's always hard to tell for sure, but definitely at least one. And there's a floating dock out at Sawmill Cove in Silver Bay that actually ends up being a nice place kind of in January and December and January, and the mers will actually come up and dive underneath the dock and then surface right at the edge of the dock. So they're like, you know, 10 feet from you. Thick-billed mer, common mers more often, but the thick-billed mer occasionally, and sometimes murrelets and things. But then they'll swim back out to the middle of the bay when they're kind of done with. I don't know if they're foraging out there. I imagine they are as well. But I'm thinking that's probably the order of like maybe 100 or 200 kind of out. And then Eastern Channel, there's more. So, I mean, it's kind of order of hundreds. Sometimes it seems like maybe 1,000 or more. Like that's usually a little later. And I imagine they're starting to gather up as herring are starting to arrive. And they're also thinking about, I mean, however they process it. But, you know, it's getting to be time for staging for breeding season. I just kind of reflecting. I'm trying to wonder, you know, numbers wise, you know, how many we have around in the winter dispersed in various deep kind of fjord bays and stuff that are just hanging around, and how many are, you know, who knows? I don't know how many are just out in the open ocean. That's like, that's pretty rough water out there, especially in the winter.
I don't think we know either. So,
yeah. Yeah, I guess, I mean, I suppose one in principle could do some sort of, basically what you're doing, a geolocator kind of over the winter. Are the MERS, I guess they'd be a little harder because accessing their nesting sites is maybe a little tricky.
Yeah, so you need to kind of use climbing gear and climb up to the colony and catch them. But we've, at some of our more accessible colonies in Alaska, we've done geolocator work with MERS.
Okay.
It's usually pretty successful. You catch them with these little nooses on the end of long poles.
Yeah.
Kind of just like fishing for them.
Oh, wow.
And it works pretty well. So you could definitely do it on the St. Louis area, but you'd, you know, just need to rope in so you don't fall off the cliff.
Right. Yeah. It's, I mean, I guess, yeah, for better and worse, it's really deep water there. So you probably wouldn't hit the rocks below, but, yeah. So the MERS, so we've talked about the storm petrels most abundant. MERS, my impression is kind of the next most abundant of seabird nesting there. And then, so after MERS, rhinoceros auklets, I that's what I see most of on the Sound, but also right near Lizaria, I more often see tufted puffins.
Yeah. So tufted puffins, rhinoceros auklets, probably a few thousand birds breeding on the island.
Of each species?
Yep.
Oh, wow. So not quite as many as the MERS, but I mean, they're less visible. I guess they're burrow nesting?
Yep. And rhinoceros auklets, like the storm petrels, are nocturnal at the colony. And so they're only there at night. So you'll see them on the water.
Yeah.
But so it's a little bit harder to get good counts of them at the colony. Whereas the tufted puffins, you'll see them standing along the tops of the cliffs and the bluffs.
Right.
And going in and out and flying around kind of during the daytime.
Yeah, they seem to like that little cove on the outside. It's sort of a cove. That seems to be where I see the biggest numbers. I always see a few in, like, on the protected side of the island.
But yeah, but
not
that
so
south
many,
side
that,
kind of just past the MERS colony, getting towards the middle of the intertidal. Yeah.
Yeah, they seem to like hanging out there for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't see those on the Sound as much. You know, you see rhinoceros auklets all over, but you don't see the tufted puffins. I don't know if they're foraging more often out further than kind of in the Sound.
So my impressions, and this is, you know, without having tracking information on them and stuff, is that the rhinoceros auklets tend to forage more inland of or inshore of the island, and tufted puffins are the opposite, a little bit more offshore.
Yeah, and that's the anecdotally, that's what I've noticed to begin seeing. I see a few tufted puffins in closer, and I've seen some rhinoceros auklets out further on the few times I've been out there, but, you know, definitely more of one than the other. And then horned puffins, just while we're on the topic of puffins, they nest further out. I know there's a cave out there. My impression is that they aren't regularly nesting on Lizaria.
They're not breeding normally on St. Lizaria, which is interesting.
Yeah. Every once in a while, you'll see one there with the tufted puffins, it seems like. But and actually, I had a chance. We were going along. It's out by Sitka Point, and there was this kind of a cave, a sea cave there. And horned puffins were flying in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, like, they just disappeared into a hole. Somehow there's a ledge, like, and a hole. I don't quite know how it works without just, like, collapsing because it's the basalt column things.
Mm.
But they were just disappearing up there. And my impression is that they are nesting out there, but not a lot of them, you know, maybe a dozen or two or something like that. But I don't, you know, not being on the refuge, probably it's not getting a lot of specific attention just from.
I occasionally hear from people who, you know, have seen them on various places and, you know, in crevices and on cruise off and that sort of thing. But we don't have any on the island.
Yeah. And is that surprising to you or? Do they like?
There's not a lot of habitat for them on the island. So they tend to kind of like talusy areas and crevices. And there's some crevices, but there tend to be not very dense concentrations of them. So pigeon guillemots, which breed on the island, kind of nest in these crevices. But horned puffins tend to like areas where they have a little bit more ability to have higher concentrations and any like areas where there's rock falls or other things, which we don't really have out there.
Right. Well, pigeon guillemots are another one that's interesting to me. You know, in Washington, when I've been on the ferry or something, like, they're nesting right at the ferry docks. They're nesting in breakwaters and places. And here, like, they nest on Lizaria. And imagine maybe they nest on some of the other sort of outer islands, but I'm not aware specifically of any nesting sites. You don't hardly see them in town. Every once in a while, I'll see one near the shore. I don't know why they're so sort of acclimated to people and nesting right around people in these other places, but here it's just like Lazaria. And there's a few of them out there. It seems like, I don't know how many, like my guess, just based on what I'd seen, is a couple dozen or something like that. Maybe.
Yeah, there's probably, upwards of 30 or 40.
Yeah.
But yeah, not a ton.
Yeah.
And they tend to be really near shore feeders, and so they're foraging right off the island.
Yeah.
And so it's probably not surprising that they're not kind of seen closer into town.
Yeah, I just don't know why they aren't nesting closer into town.
I don't know.
Especially we have this outer breakwater here. There's like hardly anybody there.
I mean, my only experience is with them on islands and stuff, but I have not experienced them kind of being around people very much. So
yeah. I just thinking along the West Coast, yeah, my impression is that they nest pretty adjacent to human activity and don't mind like breakwaters and other kind of human built sort of equivalents to where they like to nest. But yeah, I don't know. It's just something that's been a mystery to me, a curiosity to me over the last few years, especially since I had a trip in Washington where it's kind of on the state ferry, just going across Puget Sound. It's like, what's with all these, both the pigeon guillemots seem like they're pretty common around, and then the pelagic cormorants also nesting on Lazaria, but not, right in town, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah.
And so pelagic cormorants, also part of what you're monitoring?
Yes. So our crews kind of do nest counts and chick counts of pelagic cormorants every year, and depending on where they're nesting, sometimes can collect diet samples from them.
Oh.
But pelagic cormorants, well, and some of the other species of cormorants we have in Alaska too, red-faced and double-crested cormorants, they're a little bit different than a lot of the seabirds we monitor in that they don't actually have that strong fidelity to an exact nest site. And so they move around a lot, even from island to island. And so in some year, like this year, there were a lot of cormorants out there. Probably if you can count the whole backside, which we don't have a great count of, I mean, over 100.
Oh, wow.
And some years there's a dozen.
Yeah.
And some years there's two. So it's really variable from year to year because they move around a lot.
Yeah, there's some cliffs on the cruise off a little further out towards Sitka Point from Lazaria, where some years there's just a ton of pelagic cormorants nesting out there. I've heard that occasionally a double-crested cormorant nests there, but I'm not sure. I don't know if that's ever, like that showed up in y'all's data, or if that's just, sometimes people say things.
So we've seen double-crested cormorants out on the island, kind of standing around with the pelagic cormorants, one or two.
In the summer?
Yep, there were a couple out there in May this year, but we have not recorded them actually nesting out there. So that'd be cool. They build really big nests compared to the pelagic cormorants.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Wow. they're both here in the winter. They winter. And, pelagic cormorants are one of those that, you can see along the road system in the summer rarely. I mean, they're just not like in the winter, but kind of around now they start to show up more, and then as we move further into fall and then winter, they're common right along the shorelines along the road system.
Yeah.
But it seems like they move out and are, it's easy, you see a lot of them on the sound, but they aren't here. They'd be out doing their standing on the rocks thing and sunning themselves or whatever. So but they do seem to move in inshore for the winter time. And then I guess the other alcid that nests out there is the ancient murrelets, but my understanding of their sort of breeding ecology is that they lay the egg, the chick hatches. When the chick hatches, they're like, we're done, and out to the water they go. And so they don't spend the whole season there.
They're another kind of weird seabird in that the chick does most of the development at sea. So they'll lay one or two eggs, often two, and usually two chicks hatch, and then they fledge at about 2 days old. And so they follow the parents to sea, and then the parents provision them and kind of raise them through fledgling stage at sea. And it's amazing. I mean, they're just little tiny cotton balls.
Yeah, when they're heading
little
out.
Little downy things when they head out. It's amazing to me that any of them survive.
Are they, how close to the, are they burrow nesters or?
They will live in burrows or crevices, but yeah, mostly burrows.
I'm just wondering how much of a, alcids aren't notorious for their ability to walk, so how is it there? So I guess that limits where they could be anyway, because the parents need to be able to get in and out of the nest. What's that first journey like?
The chicks are pretty mobile, so they have very strong legs. And if you ever, sometimes our crews go out at night, they tend to hatch and fledge late June, early July, and sometimes you can spot them out at night, and they're almost just like little wind-up toys. Kind of scurrying around. They can get over pretty big boulders and that sort of thing, so they can kind of bounce and hop. And so they're incredibly precocial at hatch compared to a lot of the seabirds. And
yeah.
So, it's pretty amazing, but they manage to do it. It's usually a, you know, several hour process, so the adult goes ahead and kind of calls to it, and then the chicks follow a little bit, and the adult moves a little bit further and calls to it, and the chicks kind of lead it to sea.
Yeah. You know, over the last few years, I've had a little more chance to get out on the Sound in the summertime, and or a little more regularly in the summer. And one of the things that I noticed is that, you know, I just didn't see a lot of ancient murrelets, but then I started, it's like, oh, if you're out in late May and early June, they're kind of hanging around, I think, waiting for their chicks to hatch, basically, is what my impression has been. And then once the chicks hatch, if you're out when they hatch, like there's, like this year, I happen to be ancient murrelets. I don't think I had the peak, you know, saw some other folks reporting. And I was like, oh, well, they probably hit the peak or close to it. But like there were still like dozens and dozens of, and probably hundreds really, because they were scattered around. There must have been a lot of food kind of in that area off the east shore of Kruzoff Island, because there was a lot of murrelets out there and a lot of marble murrelets as well, and whales and ancient murrelets. And they were just... they were all over, and some of them were in groups that all look like adults, and some of them were definitely family groups. There's like two little cottony guys scooting along. They didn't look like they could dive. They could dive just a tiny bit and then pop back up again. And so it was fun to see them. And of course they can't fly, so they're just like swimming madly. You're in a little boat, and they're like swimming, trying to get away from you. Then they just like, I mean, they obviously aren't swimming very fast, but they just seem to just disperse. And then, you know, by later in the summer, I haven't seen one since that day, you know, since shortly after that big numbers. I think they're around, they're just little pockets, and it's easy to miss them. And it seems like they've spread out more. And then in the fall, I start to see them more in the Sound again, every once in a while, you know, just like small groups of them, presumably going for food or something. But it was just kind of curious to me, their overall behavior. So for y'all's purposes, you know, basically once they leave the island, then you can't track them anymore.
Yep, so. Our monitoring work is done. So
yeah. And what's the, I don't have a sense of, I mean, based on what I saw, I'm guessing it's kind of a couple hundred at least, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard for us to know for sure, because that's another nocturnal species, and they tend to not be quite as concentrated and dense in their breeding areas, so they're a little bit more spread out, but probably several hundred, maybe 1,000.
Okay, so yeah, so quite a few then.
Yeah.
And then yeah, it is interesting how much they must be just spreading out along the coast. I don't know if they go offshore or not when they're raising their young, but yeah, they, given how many are there and how many you see kind of in the vicinity during that period just before and after the chicks have hatched, that they become so sort of scarce in terms of being able to find them. It could also be that they're just like staying near shore in places that you aren't really going very much when you're out boating on the Sound, you know. So it is lots of questions, and some of them get answers and some of them don't. So, you know, over time, you know, you figure things out, I guess. It has been interesting. And the I guess we didn't talk about the nesting ecology of the rhinoceros auklets. Are they burrow nesters as well?
Yes.
Okay.
They are.
And so are they able to walk on land, or are they just sort of scooting themselves?
Oh, no, they can walk on land. Okay. They're very much like puffins, except they're like a nocturnal puffin.
Okay.
And they actually, ecologically, they are a puffin. They're just called a rhinoceros auklet.
I see.
But it'd be more accurate to call them like a rhinoceros puffin or something.
See.
So, yep, they can walk on land, and they do just fine, so...
I guess now that I ask that question, I'm like, oh, I've seen them standing on logs on the water. You know, they're just standing there. So that makes sense. And puffins as well, you see them standing on their perches. Marbled murrelets, are there any known to nest? I mean, I guess, I don't know how you would know. They could nest in those trees pretty easily, and I guess you wouldn't necessarily know. But I'm guessing you probably don't monitor marbled murrelets much, just because.
We don't, you know. And to my knowledge, we don't have any out there.
Yeah.
I think we would eventually know, because I think you would see them and hear them.
Oh, coming and going.
Yeah, coming and going. Our crews don't necessarily have plots all over the island, but they cover enough of it that I think we would eventually know.
Yeah, the marbled murrelets are... do they get monitored at any of the wildlife refuges? Because, I mean, it seems like they just wouldn't tend
to
nest.
Not in Alaska,
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, their nesting ecology is so strange for a seabird, you know, nesting in trees and then And then, like, I don't know, maybe they were saying that some of them were nesting 30 miles inland or something. And then, you know, you think about those young birds that I think they can't walk. So they got to land on a big enough body of water to take off again from their very first flight. And I'm like, how do they make it? But they seem to be doing all right.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah.
So these seabirds, I guess you get a chance to see, you don't spend the full summer. You kind of at the beginning, the end of the summer to help set up and take down. And then you get to do all the fun part of data analysis during the off season kind of thing. Compiling and writing reports.
Yep. Well, so our crew does some data compiling and report writing sort of through the month of September. And then they leave for the winter. And the permanent staff at our refuge does a lot more data analysis. And then come January, it's just kind of planning for the coming year.
Yeah, I imagine there's a lot of logistics. I mean, because so you have, we've talked almost exclusively about Lazaria, but in your area, region of responsibility, this is like, is it Warren and Forester Islands or something south of here? Is that
Forester Islands and Hazy Islands.
Hazy Islands
are the other kind of areas in Southeast Alaska. And then we have a lot of sites around Kodiak and down along the peninsula. So our refuge as a whole has 8 long-term monitoring sites where we have camps, like St. Lazaria is one of. But then we also do a lot of work during the summer after we set out the camps. We do a lot of kind of intermittent surveys where we visit all of the other 2,400 islands or of them.
Yeah, 2,400 is a lot. Yeah.
Kind of some of them on a rotating business basis every 5 or 10 years. Sometimes we don't get to islands for 30 or 40 years. So it's kind of more of a inventory, like what do we have on a lot of these islands. We have some islands where staff has never even visited. We just have so many, and the logistics of getting out to all these remote sites are so difficult that it takes a while to get around to all of them.
So are you, I mean, as a permanent staff, are you, I mean, you have your area, region of focus, responsibility, I guess is the word I want. Are you all, and there's different sort of staff that have their different regions, do you all kind of go together during the summer, or do you like go your own ways? I just am wondering, like, so if you do a trip to Hazy Islands or something to do a sort of a one-off look, is it just you're going there with some summer folks, or do you get to go to like the Aleutians every once in a while, or the Barents Sea or something?
It's a mix. So we each kind of have our field work that we want to do in our own area, but you always need help, right? You can't do it yourself. And so sometimes it works for the other permanent staff to come, but sometimes they're busy. And so we get a lot of volunteers. And so it's usually a mix. And in any given summer, you're probably doing most of the work in your unit, but you know, you might take one or two trips to other places to do other things.
So have you had a chance to visit Hazy Islands and Forester?
I've not been to the Forester or Hazy Islands.
Those ones are kind of out there, yeah?
Yeah.
It seems like, I mean, Lazaria is relatively accessible by standards of much of the wildlife refuge in general, being relatively protected and close to a town. But yeah, Forester and Hazy seem like they're just kind of out there.
Yep, there. So I think our refuge staff last visited there in 2016.
So it's been almost 10 years.
Yeah. Yep, almost 10 years. Oftentimes we can charter out of Craig. We also have a 120-foot research vessel as part of our refuge. And so there has been some times over the past where we've actually taken that ship down there, but it's a long way to go.
Yeah, is that one that you normally is running like the Aleutians?
Yep, typically the Aleutians and along the peninsula, occasionally up to the Pribilof areas. Sometimes we bring it all the way here. So in 2021, when COVID was still going on, we actually deployed the St. Lazaria camp directly from Homer with the ship.
Oh, wow.
Because at that point, we weren't able to travel through other communities yet for our travel restrictions and stuff. Because we only have in this part of the state those 3 island areas, it's usually not a super efficient use of our time to bring the research ship all the way here. It's like 2.5 days of travel straight across the Gulf just to get here.
Yeah.
And then you have to do other things.
Yeah.
But it has happened in the past. So
yeah.
It depends on weighing, you know, the cost of chartering and doing all that stuff versus using our ship. And so sometimes we are able to bring it out.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, you don't go into wildlife biology because you're a fan of logistics, I imagine, but logistics ends up being a big part of like being a wildlife biologist, it seems.
Yeah.
Like, just
yeah, yeah. It, you know, it's not too bad. I mean, a lot of the logistics are thinking about outdoors related things. And so, you know, I grew up camping and hiking. And so that piece of it doesn't bother me at all. It's fun trying to think about how to do remote camp setups and what you need and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so. I guess that's especially the more remote that you're like, well, you know, we can resupply. I mean, we'll have a visitor in a month. You're on your own until then, kind of thing, unless it's like a true emergency and the Coast Guard could go out or something. But some of those places I guess I've seen advertising. You mentioned you have volunteers and there are, if folks are interested in helping out with some of this stuff, are there opportunities for folks to kind of volunteer to?
Yeah. So there's multiple things. So we do have two paid technicians working out in St. Louis area every summer. And those jobs get advertised through the federal job site of USA Jobs. We would love for, you know, the opportunity to hire local people from the area to do that. And then we also bring on a lot of usually shorter term volunteers for specific projects. And on occasion, there's opportunities to work on St. Louis area, but oftentimes it's doing other surveys in other parts of our refuge.
Well, I remember my son is really into birds. And when he was a little younger, he was kind of one of the things he was considering was some stuff related to that kind of thing, and like going to the Aleutians would be kind of wild and just like interesting place, especially if you can get far out and then you start getting those Asian birds. I know some of those islands, Attu is not so easy to get to for most of us. If you're a birder, then it's nice to be there during, especially the migration season. So there are some opportunities, and just looking USA Jobs kind of thing, or is that how they, if somebody was interested in sort of the technician or
so
volunteer.
If somebody's interested in the technician position, then the USA Jobs, but most of the volunteer positions don't get advertised kind of nationally like that.
Yeah.
And so really, anybody can contact myself or any of the biologists just to let us know, hey, I'm interested. And then we usually maintain like an email list of people. And every spring when we're trying to figure things out, we send out queries to see who's available and that sort of thing. So,
well, so if folks are, if somebody is listening and is interested, what's the best way to sort of get in touch with you?
Yeah. So my email address is bree_drummond@fws.gov. And it's bree_drummond at F as in Frank, W as in Wildlife, S as in Sierra.gov. Fish and Wildlife Service.
And then, so the Fish and Wildlife site, is there a website for the Alaska National Marine Wildlife Refuge?
Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah, sorry.
Yes. Maritime. Yes, yeah, there is. But there's usually an email address there that's kind of a general email address, and it often goes to, a general person. And usually those get forwarded to the right person, but sometimes things get lost.
Fair enough, yeah. All right, well, maybe somebody will be interested. But yeah, as we're getting close to the end here, is there anything else you'd like to mention?
I don't know, just, St. Lazare is a pretty spectacular island. We love when people are interested in it. It's also, for a lot of the island, like a pretty fragile habitat. So we often run into people who come ashore on a nice day and wandering around in that rocky intertidal area, which is great. But kind of up in the trees where the birds are, there's just burrows everywhere, and that ground is so soft. And so we like to encourage people to kind of admire the wildlife from a distance and not necessarily, and just be aware of kind of causing disturbance on the island and that sort of thing. But otherwise, it's a pretty phenomenal place, and it's really kind of special to have some of our refuge islands this close to people and can actually visit and view the wildlife there.
Yeah, it's always fun to see get out there in the summer, and every once in a while, it's not unusual when you go, you'll see somebody with their, like, a field notebook or something out, you know, climbing around and looking with the binoculars, presumably during their surveys and that kind of thing. So, well, I appreciate you taking some time to visit with me, and maybe on a future trip we can check in again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
it's been great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded earlier this month with Bree Drummond of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I want to thank her for taking some time to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can hop on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCW, Sitka.